Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take AIM, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and to sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I am Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, joined today by my co-host Don Irvine, the chairman of Accuracy in Media. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Roger.
So what's on everyone's mind today, I think, is the president's speech last night and many ways to look at it. And we have two great guests today, the first one who will be up in about 15 minutes. So we'll chat in a minute. But it is a rather obscure congressman from Michigan who has become very famous recently as he has a YouTube piece that has been seen by about 3 million people, and that is Congressman Mike Rogers of Lansing, Michigan. More about him in a bit. And our second guest for the 11:30 to 12, the second half hour of this show, will be Commander Kirk Lippold, who was the captain, the commander of the USS Cole when it was hit by Al-Qaeda terrorists back on October 12th, 2000. So let's get started. Interestingly, Don, when Obama started his speech last night, he started out by taking credit, saying when he came in how we were on the brink of financial ruin, and what he did and his efforts actually pulled us back from that brink, and now we're in much better shape. And so I think that was all sort of a way of saying, trust me on health care too, I'm right about that as well. And but if you look at what's happened with the economy, has it really improved? Certainly in terms of the unemployment, the number of jobs lost per month has gone from 700,000 plus to 200,000 plus, and that's certainly a positive sign, but other things are not quite so rosy. What is your view on this?
Yes, I agree with that, Roger. The Obama's taken a very interesting viewpoint on this. I mean, besides the fact that he talked about the other on Labor Day about jobs, the job losses are now starting to trend downward, he also mentioned other things in the economy that they're theoretically are turning around, but it's not really happening. Unemployment has now risen to 9.7%. Obama promised us that if we passed the stimulus package that we would see a rate no higher than 9%. There was a story in the paper the other day about teenage unemployment is now at a record 25%. There are the number of discouraged workers is what 15 million or something like that. It's a very, very high number. So even real unemployment numbers are being masked by those that have now discouraged and are not even seeking work.
And then there's the issue of taxes and different efforts by the administration to really sort of crack down on corporations and going after their offshore accounts and things like that. All these things that are not very encouraging to business people who are basically the golden goose to pay for all these programs that Obama wants passed.
Yes, I mean businesses have been hurt, and the economy is still very, sluggish. The Fed may have reported that it looks like we're coming out of this recession, but, once again, tell that to those people that lost their jobs last month or have lost their jobs over the last couple of years. They're not seeing that. Retail operations are in a terrible fix at this point. the retail sales are really going absolutely nowhere, particularly if you account for inflation as part of that whole mix. It's just not happening. So there are things out there. In order to sell goods, they have to deeply discount them. Therefore, their profits are dropping like a stone, and they turn around. They're certainly not seeing any relief from Washington.
And look, let's be fair. I mean, you can't really blame Obama completely in the sense that he took over a really damaged economy, and the question is, have his policies made things better or worse? Some look at it with the idea that the massive spending that he has put in over the next decade or so to propose spending, you know, will just create unsustainable deficits that will have a really damaging effect. And now you're seeing even the Chinese are questioning the spending going on here and what it's doing to the dollar, and their moves both at the UN and China and to replace the U.S. dollar as the main currency in the world.
Yes, I think that we saw with this dollar slide just recently, in with gold touching that $1,000 mark again per ounce, that the confidence factor in our economy is way down from the international side of things. It's a big problem that we're going to face, and you're right that you can't give all the blame to Obama for the economy, but on the other hand, he's been in office for nearly 8 months, and he hasn't really taken a lot of responsibility for things that are going on. He still prefers, when he can, to blame the predecessors in the previous administration for the woes that he's suffering through. And he mentioned that last night.
Well, as I said, we're going to be talking in a little while with Congressman Mike Rogers about the health care issue, and one thing I saw this morning on the Today Show, Matt Lauer was interviewing John McCain, Senator McCain, about this, and I think they brought him on, as he is often brought on, as sort of this model of bipartisanship, someone who sort of gives cover to a lot of Democratic and liberal causes, and while he generally has a conservative voting record, but what I found interesting is Matt Lauer started out asking him about what was the sort of the big moment of the night when Republican Congressman Joe Wilson of South Carolina shouted out that you're lying or you're a liar when Obama said something to the effect that illegal immigrants will not be covered by his plan. And Wilson later apologized, but when asked about that by Matt Lauer, McCain said no, that according to the bills that he's seen, there is no coverage for illegal immigrants in there. And so it raises the question, what is the plan under the Obama plan to do this? I mean, we notice they've cut the figures. They've been saying 46 or 47 million people uninsured. Last night, for the first time, he said 30 million, which raises another question. So the number of illegal aliens is now thought to be 16 or 17 million as opposed to the 10 or 11 they've been saying. So anyway, then they got into a number of other things, like he asked him, because Sarah Palin had brought up the term death panels, and he asked McCain about that, and McCain said, well, no, but with the $500 million in cuts in Medicare, that will ultimately lead to rationing, which, will ultimately lead to people having choices made that will effectively take their lives.
Yeah, so, I think there are a couple things there, obviously. I mean, on the illegal alien, I don't know that there is anyone who really can believe or does believe that even under Obamacare, that if an illegal alien shows up to an emergency room and needs treatment, that they're going to be turned away. Well, then who's going to be paying for those services, that care that illegal alien does receive? It's not clear exactly what happens there. As far as rationing, I think that I take that somewhat personally. My mother's about to turn 90 years old, and you know, when she had her last hip replaced a couple of years ago, there was no question that that's what they were going to do. I mean, they just said your mother needs a hip replacement, and therefore we're going to do it. And so it went forth, and it was very successful. Under Obamacare, I think that would be a very different scenario. I mean, that they would look at the life expectancy and the health and determine, you know, and look at the cost of providing that, which is, you know, quite high, and may come back and say, you know, it doesn't really add up. It's not economically, it doesn't make any sense for us to go and replace that hip or replace, you know, or do whatever, a kidney, whatever the causes may be. Maybe it's a knee joint or whatever, because of the high cost of doing those types of procedures.
Another question that Lauer brought up to McCain is that one of Obama's principles is that this is going to curb costs. And McCain said, no way. He pointed to the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office's estimates of how much that this is going to cost $1 trillion. And then the question is about paying for it. And one of the things they talk about is, this half a trillion or so to be cut from the Medicare program, basically the old waste, fraud, and abuse canard, and you know that, which raises the question: why not just do that now anyway? They should be, if they can find that much in waste, fraud, and abuse in the program, why not just start eliminating that? You don't need legislation for that.
Right. They, as you said, I mean, it's an old canard. They've been dealing with this for years. If they have truly identified those things, then let's go ahead and take care of that waste now. Exactly what is the motivation or the plan going on here? You know, the idea that the president says that, you know, this is going to cost $900 billion, but it won't add one dime to the deficit, it just seems to be extremely unrealistic, you know, based on what the CBO has said about this plan going forward. And I don't know who's drinking whose Kool-Aid here. How many of the Democrats really truly believe that they can get that done? It seems to me that Pelosi is going to have a very tough time trying to, you know, manage to get this thing through on this basis of saying, well, if we're going to hew to the president's promise of not adding to the deficit at all. I don't see how they're going to do this.
And another issue is tort reform, and that. Obama made a suggestion last night that he would follow in the footsteps of George W. Bush. You don't hear that too often, in setting up some sort of demonstration program that they would take a look and see if tort reform really does anything. And a couple things. McCain this morning dismissed that as not a real offer. By the way, he also said, as far as bipartisanship, that Republicans really haven't been invited to the table and their ideas haven't been listened to. And you know, tort reform is a big one because there's hundreds of billions of dollars in defensive medicine practice that most doctors really wouldn't necessarily recommend to their patients, but they do it out of a sense of overcaution so they won't get sued. But I heard Karl Rove last night talking about this, and he said that what actually happened was that the Bush administration tried to get tort reform, but of course we know that trial lawyers are a major constituency for the Democratic Party, and the Democrats wouldn't let that go through. So as an alternative, Bush then decided to set up these demonstration programs, which really never got off the ground either.
Yeah, so, I think that's a good point to make. The trial lawyers are definitely a huge backer of the Democratic Party. I was surprised that, you know, Obama even mentioned that, because as a conservative, my first thought went straight to the trial lawyers, and I thought, you know, what's this going to be like? You know, and I do know a gynecologist who he doesn't do private practice. You know, he's with a group with Kaiser.
Don, let me interrupt you. I think we have our Congressman Rogers on the line here. Let me see. Congressman Rogers, are you with us?
I certainly am.
Terrific. This is Roger Aronoff and Don Irvine, my co-host. And
Roger and Don, it's great to hear you.
Great to have you on. So let me just tell a little about you before we start talking. And
sure.
That is that before being elected to the House from Michigan, the capital, you had served as a U.S. Army officer and company commander. You were an FBI special agent investigating public corruption as a member of the Chicago Bureau's Organized Crime Unit. And then you were also in the Michigan Senate for a number of years. And I guess you were, first elected in 2000?
I was. That's correct.
Great. Okay.
So as my dad said, I can't keep a job.
You've had some fascinating jobs.
I really have. I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, we could do a whole show on your Chicago Bureau Organized Crime Unit.
You
I'd
bet.
To hear about that.
I love to talk about it too. It's great stuff. Really enjoyed the work there.
Well, you went viral, as they say, recently on YouTube with your opening statement at a recent hearing on one of the healthcare bills, and I checked last night, and it shows that it's been viewed to about 3 million times now.
So yeah, which is really something.
You're a celebrity now.
I don't know about that. But you know what I think caught their attention, Roger, is the fact that it was plain speak, and it challenged the underpinning of, you know, what role the government plays. And it was just a simple presentation. It's not because I was some great orator that's going to bring a tear to your eye. I think the message just resonated with average Americans who knew instinctively that the government should not take over one-sixth of the American economy and get involved between them and their doctor. I think that's really what it was.
I think so. Did President Obama's speech last night make you feel any better about what the Democrats are hoping to pass in the name of health care reform?
Well, it was a new speech, but it's the same old plan, and that really is the problem. There is nothing in there that is outside of what has been introduced by the House, and he was very careful about how he parsed his words. And let me give you a great example. If you remember before, and this is what was so disappointing about that speech to me, he says, if you liked your health care plan, you can keep it. And he's had 30-some very major press conferences or speeches on health care in the last couple months, 37, I think it is. And so he's been very clear about that. If you like your health care plan, you can keep it. Well, last night he said something just enough different. You had to listen. It says nothing in this bill requires you to give up your health care plan. And then he reset it again. Nothing in this bill requires. That is a change, and it's significant, because the bill that's introduced you're right, he's right, technically. It doesn't require you. However, it drives you off of private coverage into this government-mandated exchange that has a government board that approves all plans in the federally government-mandated exchange. So it's clever by half, but I think it's disingenuous. And clearly, the truth of the matter had been catching up with the administration because they had to change their language because clearly you don't get to keep your health care bill. The incentives and the regulations and the punitive side of this thing pushes you into a government plan.
Is that primarily because of the 8% fine that employers could pay instead of paying for health insurance for everyone? Is that the
there's two points to it. One is, and you think about this, on average, it's somewhere between 15% to 16% based on payroll. So for every employee, the employer pays about 15% of the total wages in health care purchasing. So the government came in and said, we're only going to charge you 8% if you don't have health insurance. So immediately, you think about how much money that makes for those individual businesses to get off of it. And we call it cascading. So what happens is your competitor says, well, I'm not going to pay the whole 16%. Why would I do that? You can go on the government plan. And it cascades. And we think it's as many as 114 million people get shoved off of their health care. But there's also another provision that's very clever. It says at 4 years from the day the bill is signed, that any change to your policy that you have today, and this is under their grandfather clause, any change at all, meaning if you hire one person or you add a new cancer drug that didn't exist this year or next year but in the third year to your formulary, changes it. And once you change that grandfathered bill that you like you get to keep, you have to go through the government-mandated exchange in order to have a qualified government plan through the federal exchange. So either way, they've got you. They've got incentives for you to get off of the employer to give up the health care, number one. And number two, any changes whatsoever means that that plan has to go through the federal exchange at some point in its life anyway. So the best you can hope for is you get to keep your plan for 4 years uninterrupted. And that it absolutely will have to change unless your employer doesn't hire anybody. And if that's their plan, we're all in trouble.
You, in your comments on in the YouTube piece, you said that the bill gives the federal government unprecedented power, and you referred to Section 141, the Health Choices Commissioner Act, I believe.
Yes.
What does that do?
What it says is that the commissioner, 141 creates it, and the very next section that's part of that talks about what authority he has. And it is an incredibly powerful position. It does two things in the Health Commission. First, it says every doctor, so think about what this means, I think, to the Constitution and the First Amendment. Every doctor, because you've gone to school and paid all that debt and got your medical degree, automatically is enrolled in the government plan, automatically. And in order to get off of it, saying, well, hey, I don't want to do that, I don't want to participate, you have to go to the health commissioner and petition to get off. And there's no other legal recourse for it. So if he decides that he wants you on, doctor, guess what? You've lost the ability to make that choice, number one. And number two, it gives the commissioner the ability to go into a business, any business in the country, without cause, and make the determination if you are what they decide is a federally compliant health care plan. And they can enroll by the statute. They can unenroll individuals or the whole plan with no notification process and no adjudication. In other words, today you could have your health care plan. The Health Choices Commissioner or his representative comes into your business and says, oh, I don't like X or Y. They can unenroll that person or that plan. And that is unprecedented federal power. Unprecedented.
Wow.
And it's a little scary, and that's what's been so frustrating to me, because the president, I mean, got up and said that people who disagree with him are lying about what's in the bill, and he's going to hold them accountable as he wagged his finger. I think that's a very dangerous place to go, that we now turn the federal government into coming after people because they disagree when there's this kind of federal expansion in law. I mean, it's in type. They can't deny it. That's not a fear tactic. That's their bill. And that worries me. If they call that a fear tactic, I would encourage them all to read the bill. It's in the bill.
Congressman, this is Don Irvine.
Hey, how are you, sir?
Fine. How would you propose that the private sector fix the healthcare system?
Oh, great. That's a good question. We've got a lot of great things that we have proposed. Let me give you a couple of them. One is high-risk pools, which we argue does a couple of things. It takes the sickest of the sick out of the premium payer pool around the country and allows them to go in to a pool when they're sick. So if you get cancer and you get that $1 million medical bill to get treated, or a serious auto accident or something, you go into this pool. And what it allows the premium payers to do is pay based on what the average consumer uses plus a little bit to cover the extra catastrophic cost. So instead of paying, $15,000, you base your premium on what the average American uses per year. This is all complicated stuff. That's why nobody talks about it. $2,400 a year. So now your premiums automatically come down. That's one way we can do it. And everybody participates in that, providers, doctors, insurance companies, to get people into this high-risk pool. Secondly, we allow small business pooling. Currently today, it's against the law for the local chamber of commerce who goes out and buys a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan to join up with the auto parts association down the street to negotiate better rates. Can't do that. So what we do is say, all right, we want to put pressure on increasing rates. Insurance companies don't like these things, by the way, and because competition, they know, is going to drive down prices. And we ought to allow them to do that. Now, the president actually talked about that in a speech last night, except he wants the government to run it. We argue that the free market can do that. So those are A2. Tort reform is a huge one. We agree on pre-existing conditions. We think we can get that in and make that work for average folks, including something called rescission, where you're on the operating table and they call up and say, gee, that's great, but you're not covered. We think, you know, you got to have terms, and contracts mean you got to pay your obligations, Mr. Insurance Company, because you made it. And we can do those things and have a tremendous impact. Expansion of health savings accounts, which, by the way, this bill takes away, are great free market ways to allow insurance companies to compete, which right today they're so regulated they don't compete with each other, which means higher prices. And we're going to get better access, better care, and better quality all at the same time.
Now, back to your YouTube video, you said in that video that we would be punishing the 85% for the 15% who don't have insurance. What do you mean by that?
Well, in order for this to work, you're going to have to push the 85% of individuals who have coverage, who have earned it. They've earned this coverage in one way, shape, or form, and that includes even Medicare people. They've paid in, right, for 40 years, if not more, of their working lives into Medicare, right, without drawing a penny. And now they've on it. So 85% of the Americans have it. And this is by their own numbers. And we were even a little generous. We think it's less than that. But we just took them at their word, and they say about 50 million or 47 million don't have insurance. Okay. As a matter of fact, I think the president last night said 30, which is a huge change. Okay. So we have 15% that need coverage. We have a 15% problem that we need to work on and fix. So what they've done is created a system that says the 85% who have health insurance are going to be punished in a couple of ways. One, in 4 years, you're going to lose the health care that you have. You have to go through the federally mandated exchange, so you're not going to get to keep the health care that you have. Oh, and by the way, if the government deems that you have a good health care plan, they're going to tax it, which the president again stated last night. So that's a bounty on people who have health insurance. That's another clear way of getting people to drop their coverage and push you into the government plan. And so here you go. You're going to take the 250 million Americans who have earned health care coverage and tell them, you know what, we're going to punish you. It must be your fault. We're going to have to take it away from you in some way, shape, or form, or certainly lessen what you have in order to try to fix the other 50 million Americans who don't have health care. I don't know any other problem set that you would do that, that you would destroy the part that's working to fix the part that's not. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Another concern is that this bill, H.R. 3200, seems to give new powers to the IRS. I mean, they seem to have a big role in this in terms of, access to your banking information, all kinds of ways that they're involved in this. Is this something that disturbs you, or what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, any time that you allow the government to have, without any due process, which this does, a lot of it in a lot of places, I get worried, because now the IRS is already, known to rough up some folks on some questionable tactics out there. You're now going to give them access to more of your information. It's the enforcement arm in this bill on matters of health care, because a big part of it is driven through the tax code. So now you have not only the IRS worried about what your income tax is, now they're worried about your health care status as well. It makes me very uncomfortable to do that. And I argue it may even have some constitutional problems. Just like I think it's unconstitutional to say, well, because you're an American citizen that earned your doctorate degree in medicine, the government has the right to control who you associate with. I think that's a problem constitutionally. The notion that we're going to tell some stories that do break your heart and say, because of those, we should break the whole system and allow the IRS to get into your personal business, including your banking accounts, is troublesome. And I hope that we don't allow them to present the problem in a way that we give up on what has been an American tradition of entrepreneurship to solve our problems, in our own involvement in our own health care, which would all go away under what is clearly designed to push people in a government-run health care plan.
Yeah, the bill is full of things like that, that just really, when you get into them, you know, the Republican response last night, he talked about how there's 53, I believe, new bureaucracies created. I mean, is this bill, do you think it's going to pass? What do you see happening?
Well, I don't know. I have to tell you, it was very confusing. The president said, I want to work with you if you have a plan, but we have not been included in any of the meetings since April. And I don't, he says he has, this is his plan, but then he has already come out and supported 3200, the bill you mentioned, and we're confused. Does this mean that the president is going to propose a new bill? I don't know. I don't think they know. You know, the Senate has said we've already produced the bill. That's the bill we have. The president in his speech mentioned the four bills. We've made progress. So we are as confused as ever, after the speech. More so than we were before it. I wish I could tell you where we're going. I'm not even sure the president knows where he's going.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it. I want to ask you one final question on an unrelated topic, because when I was looking over your website, I see that you have been involved in efforts to get U.S. officials to enforce trade laws that would prevent China from manipulating its currency. But which brought up a question to me, something that I read about happening that it's just kind of a shocker and that doesn't seem to be making waves, is that on September 20th, there's going to be a ceremony on the White House, on the South Lawn of the White House, basically celebrating 60 years of the communist government in China. I mean, A, are you aware of that?
I am not. I'm not aware of it. That's surprising. But I'm going to tell you how this is, what, you know, this is happening, in my opinion, and I'm not aware of the event. But think about this. What the United States had to send this Secretary of the Treasury over to tell the Chinese, no, everything's fine. Please keep buying our Treasury bonds because we are escalating the debt and the deficit at an alarming and breathtaking pace. That didn't work, so they sent the Secretary of State over also to beg them to lend us money for our ravenous spending here. There's more deficit that this president has brought to this to the United States since he's been in office than all of the other presidents of the United States combined. And so it doesn't surprise me that they have to get on their knees and beg the Chinese to keep lending us money, that they wouldn't have some celebration for them on the White House lawn. That should alarm every American citizen to say, all right, enough is enough. Quit spending that money that way. And I can tell you lots of great reasons why we should spend money. But at the end of the day, Americans know if you outspend what you can earn in your family, somebody's going to get hurt. Well, the federal government is absolutely no different. And the people who get hurt are all of us across the country.
Well, listen, Congressman Rogers, it's been great having you here. We'd love to have you back and get into this a lot more.
I'd love to do it, Roger. Thanks, Roger and Don. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Now let's move right into our next guest, which is Commander Kirk Lippold. Are you on the line, sir?
I am. How are you today?
Doing great, thank you. Let me tell our listeners a little about you first, and then we'll get right into this. Commander Kirk Lippold, U.S. Navy retired, was the commanding officer of the USS Cole on October 12, 2000, when the ship was attacked and bombed by al-Qaeda terrorists during a refueling stop in the Yemeni port of Aden, killing 17 U.S. sailors. He was later involved with crafting the policy regarding detainees in the War on Terror, and is a senior military fellow with Military Families United, an advocacy group opposed to the release of prisoners held in Guantanamo. So, fascinating. Would you tell us a little about yourself, where you grew up, and then a brief description of your Navy career leading up to October 12th?
Absolutely. I grew up in Carson City, Nevada. Graduated from high school there and went to the United States Naval Academy, where I graduated, received my commission in 1981, and served on a variety of ships, mostly Aegis cruisers and guided missile cruisers and guided missile destroyers. That culminated with my taking command of USS Cole in June of 1999, where I was in command for approximately a little over a year before we deployed, first to the Mediterranean for 2 months and then to the Arabian Gulf. The mission of the ship as we went into the Arabian Gulf region early October 2000 was to eventually check in with Fifth Fleet in the port of Bahrain, get some briefings there, and we are going to be enforcing United Nations sanctions against the country of Iraq. Unfortunately, because of our fuel state, we had to pull into the port of Aden, Yemen, and what was supposed to be a routine port visit obviously changed in about an instant. And next thing we knew is we had a 40-by-40-foot hole in the side of the ship. 17 of my sailors were killed, 37 were injured, and we would get everybody off the ship and get USS Cole up onto the heavy lift ship Blue Marlin, where it has been brought back to the United States. I stayed with the ship for several months after she came back. It was repaired and has completed its third deployment and working up to its fourth deployment after the attack to go defend our freedom.
Commander Lippold, this is Don Irvine. Did you have any warning of this attack?
We had absolutely no warning whatsoever. All of the messages that we had at the time indicated that it was going to be, while an elevated threat true for the region, there was no specific intelligence that pointed to any attack or impending attack. That morning when we pulled in, we contracted for 3 garbage barges to come out to the ship, rather routine for when you're in port. 2 had come out to the ship. 2 had left. The 3rd boat that came out followed the same path, and we would later learn that Al-Qaeda had actually done an excellent job in operationally casing a pending attack. They had spent about a year and a half, almost 2 years, planning it. They had set up a safe house in there, and in fact, we would learn after the attack on Cole that they had attempted an attack on a U.S. Navy ship that had pulled in for the same type of refueling operation that I underwent in January of 2000. That attack failed. Nobody in the intelligence community picked it up. Consequently, Al-Qaeda regrouped, came back to the port after several months, gathered up all the gear they'd left behind, moved to a new safe house, redid the mission. And like 9/11, when they were ready, they were ready. Nobody was specifically targeting USS Cole, but instead, the next Navy ship that pulled in after they said, we've got the green light and we're ready to go, that's when it happened.
So what happened in the aftermath in terms of how the Clinton administration responded?
Well, I think it's unfortunate for 2 administrations. The Clinton administration, on one hand, was anxious to get out of office and did nothing more than want to wrap up an investigation where they could close the books, put it behind them and say we're done, because the last thing they wanted was an open investigation left out there for any the next administration to take over and say, why are we inheriting this mess? You know, when you think back, we got hit on October 12th. 3.5 weeks later, what happened? We were all worried about hanging chads and who was going to be our next president in the Supreme Court decision, and USS Cole very quickly and unfortunately faded from the public's eye. The Clinton administration left office saying, we're done with the investigations, we're finished, goodbye. The Bush administration came in and, for right or for wrong, said, hey, we're forward-looking, not backward-acting. And what you had was a disconnect because of politics. No action was taken. And 11 months later, the nation would pay a very tragic price. And even the 9/11 Commission said, because there was no consistency in U.S. government policy that would cause our nation to react to the attack on Cole, it in fact emboldened Al-Qaeda to carry out the 9/11 attacks because they felt that they were beyond accountability and that nobody was going to do anything unless we really got hit hard, which is unfortunate.
So there's often a distinction. Was this treated by the government, Clinton or the Bush, as an act of war or a criminal act?
The Clinton administration treated it as a criminal act. I mean, at the time, the mindset in our nation was one of, you know, let's turn it over to the FBI. The FBI has done an absolutely fabulous job on gathering a lot of evidence. The Bush administration similarly treated it as a criminal event, although it took a back burner when they took office. When 9/11 hit, we're now in an area where, geez, where the attack on coal, was it, should we go back and look at it as an act of war, which I fundamentally believe it was, but the current administration clearly has felt that we're not even fighting any kind of war on terror right now because that might offend people. And so consequently, we're sitting there in this gray area where the attack on coal has criminal elements to it, but I believe it was an act on war. And I'll tell you why. The fundamental difference between the attack on coal and other attacks by Al-Qaeda is that a building like Khobar Towers or like embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya, they represent U.S. interests. A Navy ship goes worldwide to defend national interests. When you attack something that has the ability to defend national interests, in my book, that's an act of war.
Well, what happened to your career in the Navy as a result?
Well, fortunately, my career went on. I was able to come off of USS Cole following a change of command, normal change of command. I went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where I worked in the J-5, which is called the Strategy and Policy Directorate. And I had only been there about 6 weeks working in the Pentagon when 9/11 occurred. And consequently, the office I was in was global in nature, and they turned to us and said, being the only one in the strategy and policy directorate that's global, you're going to handle this new mission called detainee policy. And so the office I was in was instrumental in crafting, okay, we know we're going to go into Afghanistan. Who are we going to capture in at one level for Al-Qaeda and Taliban? Once we capture them, where are we going to keep them? Initially Kandahar and Bagram, but eventually we had to find a place outside of country because of political and military circumstances at the time, so Guantanamo Bay was picked. So we picked Guantanamo. Once we were going to Guantanamo, we had to figure out what interrogation techniques would be used by the military. I'm not talking other government agencies, but by the military. And then eventually, once we determined that a detainee no longer represented a threat to U.S. interests, or no longer represented intelligence value to the United States, how do we transfer them back to their home countries? So that was kind of the policy aspect related to detainees that I was involved in for 3.5 years.
And
but
so
anyway, continued on with that, went to the Navy staff for 2.5 years doing international strategy in June 2007 when my name was permanently removed from the promotion list to captain by the Navy. I decided that like any good job in the Navy, it's never a job for life when you serve your country, unfortunately, and you have to go out and find real work, and I thoroughly enjoyed my 26 years in there.
That's great. So when your naval career ended, how did you become involved with Military Families United? Tell us what that organization is all about.
Well, Military Families United is a great organization. They represent over 100,000 blue and gold star families. Blue star meaning they've got someone in the family that's actively serving in our armed forces. Gold stars, I'm sure you remember, is from a family member has been killed in the line of duty. And they represent a unique niche when it comes to representing these families. Well, there are a number of organizations out there that try to represent the families when it comes to benefits and services and things like that. What Military Families United does is we want to represent these families in the policy debates. And the reason we want to do that with policy is because what happens and the decisions made with policy affecting our armed forces ultimately determines where they're deployed, when they're deployed, how they're deployed, and how many are deployed. And so consequently, shaping that policy debate where the families can have a say, we felt was very, very important because families are the ones that ultimately have to live with the consequences of their soldier, sailor, airman, or marine deciding to raise their right hand and live a life of consequence in service to the nation. So being able to represent the families, the executive director had heard of me. We sat down over a cup of coffee, what was supposed to be a 30-minute interview, and 3.5 hours later, we shook hands, and I couldn't believe the wonderful opportunity I'd been given, and it has been a wonderful relationship and an absolute joy to work with them and represent these families.
That's great. So shortly after Obama became president, you sat down with him, I guess, in your capacity with Military Families United to discuss his plans to close down Guantanamo. What happened at that meeting?
Well, it was a meeting in February, and what had happened, I had just come on board with Military Families United. The White House had invited me principally because of my role as the commanding officer of USS Cole. It was unique in that it was the first time that a president had met with the USS Cole families. President Bush had declined to meet with them for the 8 years he had been in office. And while it was unique, unfortunately, it was held on such a short notice that only about 5 or 6 families actually showed up besides me. But nonetheless, it at least was an opportunity for these families to express their concern, to express their appreciation that the president was finally recognizing that the attack on USS Cole was a key part of the war on terror. And even though a lot of people like to define it started 9/11, I look at that act of war as actually starting on 10/12, a year earlier. So it was a good meeting, but the president wanted to explain to us why he was closing Guantanamo Bay, why he was dropping the charges against the principal conspirator for USS Cole, a guy named al-Nashiri, and the families listened. But quite frankly, all the families, while willing to give the president a little maneuvering room and time to resolve the issues related around Guantanamo Bay, they clearly expected him to hold those detainees down there accountable, especially those that had been involved in 9/11 and the attack on USS Cole. Unfortunately, we've seen no movement down there. The president set up a task force to review what was going on in Guantanamo Bay and how we were going to approach it. He gave them 6 months to complete their work. At the six-month point, he extended their work for another 6 months because the president realized very quickly that these families are watching him like a hawk. They're watching what he is doing with the detainees down in Guantanamo Bay. There is no real reason anymore for closing Guantanamo Bay. He says it's because of world opinion, but all you have to do is look around the world and realize that every country we've tried to approach to take detainees or work with us on closing Guantanamo wants nothing to do with it, because they do in fact realize that out of the almost 800 detainees that have cycled through that facility, we're now down to the hardcore, about 230, 240 remaining, that truly represent a threat to the United States or our interests, our allies, or, in the case of some of them, they still possess what we feel is intelligence value that would help us to understand al-Qaeda.
A couple of weeks ago, a federal judge ordered the release of Mohammed Jawad. Who is he, and why did this get your attention?
Well, it got our attention because, quite frankly, without any policy or plans in place for how to close Guantanamo Bay, with a task force that the president had put into motion to determine the status of each detainee, report back to him, and then determine what he was going to do, the administration suddenly realized that they had stepped into a political quagmire by making a political decision to close Guantanamo Bay without thinking through the second and third order effects of what was going to happen to the detainees should they be turned loose. In the case of Mohammed Jawad, there was clear evidence, a lot of it within intelligence channels, that he had been involved in attacks, that he should not have been released, and the administration chose to make a political decision and release him kind of as a test to see how the world was going to react. And clearly Military Families United said, hey, look, we have young men and women that are out there willing to give their lives to capture these terrorists and put them away. We don't need an administration that is more concerned about the world's opinion of us than the reality of our troops dying to capture terrorists. And that's why we're speaking up.
Okay. You've also expressed concern about a possible deal to release a number of terrorists back to Yemen, though Yemen is not cooperating with us on the still ongoing investigation into the bombing of the Cole. Tell us about that.
Well, I will be right up front with you. Any decision by the administration to transfer the Yemeni detainees to either Yemen or Saudi Arabia, where they would receive this, quote, rehabilitation, unquote, it is a slap in the face to the families and the crew of USS Cole, who had to go through and live with the consequences of that attack. The Yemeni's government today has one of the other co-conspirator, a guy named al-Badawi. He is essentially walking the streets of the capital, Sana'a, Yemen, a free man, because the government of Yemen will not hold him accountable. They will not give the FBI access to him. They will not allow us to charge him. They will not extradite him to the United States to face justice. And for some reason they feel that, well, we should give all those people back in Guantanamo because they're our citizens. I'm sorry, but there's a fundamental difference when it comes to accountability and what the world thinks of us. Those detainees down there in Guantanamo Bay represent a threat to the United States. The government of Yemen has not helped us in the war on terror. And it's not that we're holding those detainees as political chips. We're holding them because they threaten to attack or have attacked U.S. troops or interests and represent a continuing and ongoing threat. And that's why they should not be released to either Yemen or Saudi Arabia, because quite frankly, Saudi Arabia's rehabilitation program has not proven effective over time. We have people that we have released to Saudi Arabia that have returned to the battlefield that continue to fight against our troops today.
So you said that the Obama administration basically has no policy, no plan what to do with the detainees. What do you think is going on in the inner sanctum of the National Security Council, the Pentagon? Do you think people like Gates and Jones are concerned with this? I mean, are you hearing anything? Go ahead.
I'll tell you exactly what I think is happening. Right now, Secretary Gates has abrogated his responsibility to oversee detention of enemy combatants during a war effort. Guantanamo Bay has essentially been taken over and is now being run by the Justice Department and Eric Holder. No detainees leave that facility or get streamed without the Attorney General's specific approval and request. Consequently, you have lawyers that are more concerned with meeting a U.S. criminal standard of justice being applied to the detainees rather than treating them as they should be, which are enemy combatants in wartime. We have a right under international law to detain enemy combatants for the duration of the conflict. Al-Qaeda started the conflict against us. They're the ones that picked this fight. We're the ones that are continuing to try and stabilize the country of Afghanistan, and we're fighting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda today to be able to do that. And I will tell you that the fact that the Secretary of Defense has abrogated that responsibility, that the White House directed them to do that, and that the White House told the Attorney General to take over this problem is creating all sorts of complications, because you no longer have an administration that is willing to hold enemy combatants accountable for their actions on the battlefield.
You also said that the Obama administration delayed the outcome of a task force until January, when they're going to close the doors at Gitmo. Well, what's going on there?
Well, I think what you're seeing is that the administration very quickly understood that because of the politics involved in their decision to close Guantanamo Bay, you are seeing that rather than telling the nation, sharing with Congress and the American people what the president wants to do with the detainees in Guantanamo Bay, and with the facility down there, they have chosen instead to make decisions, release detainees, go forward and create a plan without any congressional oversight or approval, and release all those detainees one way or another in order to achieve a political objective. The other problem you're going to run into is, while you may want to close it, they're trying to bring them here to the United States. All you have to do is look at the facilities where the Department of Defense and Department of Justice have gone around and said, okay, let's look at all these brigs in Charleston, in California, at Miramar, the Marine Corps Air Station there. They have looked at facilities at Fort Leavenworth, where the Army has the U.S. disciplinary barracks at the base there. They have looked at civilian prisons at Standish. They have looked at how many could we fit into the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. They are trying to do that. And the problem is, if you bring the detainees here it will trigger constitutional safeguards because they will have set foot on U.S. soil. And the last thing we need to do is clear the slate with every detainee in Guantanamo Bay, read them their Miranda rights, and start the whole process over again. The correct venue for trying these detainees is a military commissions process. It is mirrored after the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Senator McCain has made some tweaks to it that would allow it to function in a manner that would withstand Supreme Court scrutiny, but the administration seems hell-bent on ignoring everyone in this country who does not want Guantanamo Bay to be closed, and instead is more interested in appeasing our perceived allies' interests overseas because all the human rights groups complaining about Guantanamo Bay, rather than realizing that we have a right to detain them, and Guantanamo Bay is an effective facility to do that.
Okay, let me ask you this. Considering that we've never been in a war like this one, how should we deal with the issue of detaining people when this war could last for many years? I mean, this isn't a war that we're going to have a signing, somebody's going to surrender and it's over. So how should this be dealt with?
Well, I think, quite frankly, I look at it, and I sometimes wonder why there's so much angst about this whole thing. One thing the administration needs to do is define what they see as the end of the conflict with al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Clearly, the ongoing war effort in Afghanistan is indicative that when it comes to the Taliban, we do not want to allow them to recreate a safe haven that lets al-Qaeda operate. But if al-Qaeda were to renounce violence and decide to pursue their objectives via peaceful or political means, that might be one end that you could have. The reality of it is that we have a right to detain people on the battlefield. If we do capture them, I think that the criteria that we initially laid out 8 years ago when the war started would still work. And that is, these detainees can no longer represent a threat to the United States, our allies, or our interests, and they no longer are of intelligence value. We're going to capture a lot of people in this war, both high-level people and foot soldiers. A lot of these foot soldiers, in reality, would probably be just as happy if they could be, if we could talk to them and find a way to repatriate them back to their countries and help their nations reintegrate them back into their societies. We've done that around the world for decades in other countries to try and provide the means for countries to allow them to reintegrate into their society. Most of them, they just want to be able to provide for their families and have a job. Some of them have been forced into fighting by the Taliban and by others, and that is the last thing they want to do. Our job needs to be to get them. And if they're willing to do that, that's how you slowly cull through and filter out the ones that can meet that criteria that we can then help reintegrate back into their society so that they can become contributing members of a country that is not going to wish to do us harm as a nation.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up, so let me ask you one more question. What should we be doing to win this war, and how critical is the role of Iran and al-Qaeda in this war? I know that's a big question, but see if you can give us an answer in the last minute or so here.
I would say the first thing we need to do is look to the administration and stop playing political games when it comes to fighting the war on terror. Keep Guantanamo Bay open. We've already invested $300 million in that facility. Bring high-level al-Qaeda and Taliban, as we capture them worldwide, to that facility in order to learn how al-Qaeda recruits, trains, equips, finances, and carries out operations worldwide. Because if you understand how your enemy fights, then you can target it for defeat. But that's got to be what we need to do, is hold the administration accountable for what they're doing and don't release these detainees who will return to the battlefield to kill Americans again.
Okay.
Now, with Iran,
yes,
we need to hold that country accountable, quite frankly, through not only the international community, but other nations as well that have the backbone to do it. Right now, trying to appease them by saying, we are willing to talk, the door is open, the hand is out, we've already seen what they're doing. They're continuing to progress forward with their nuclear program. They are supplying arms and ammunition to the Taliban through the back door going into Afghanistan. And quite frankly, we should be tired of fighting a proxy war with this country. We've done it before around the world. It does not work. We need to start looking at it and telling Iran, you want to know something? If you're going to fight a proxy war, we're not going to fight proxy wars. We're going to start holding you accountable, and if that means that we are going to turn to you, and if diplomatic efforts fail and economic efforts fail, and if we can't get the United Nations to agree that these people need to be held accountable, then by God, we as a nation will stand up and hold them accountable.
Thank you so much and for your great service to this country, and thank you all for listening to Take Aim, and we will be back next week.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.